And hopefully they'll join us just as soon as possible. This is Representative Krieger in the back.
That's correct.
Right. Welcome. And then we're going to move as quickly as we can to our presentation from Washington. And are you Mr. Ballard?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Welcome. The first thing we're going to do is just take care of some business. We are not going to spend a lot of time on the on task force business today because we do have this presentation and we want to do that. But you should have received in your materials the templates, and this is what we worked on last time. And what I'd like to do with these is not work on filling them out, obviously, because that's going to take some time in doing, but I've had a suggestion that what we could do is if we could get someone to adopt each one as kind of the lead person, then each person could fill in their area on the template and send that information to the lead person, who could then work on getting it put together for our next meeting, getting rid of the redundancies and getting it filled in. And so that's one plan that I've heard about how to handle these. Any thoughts or concerns about that? Does that sound like a good one? Would you each want to take one? Okay, so why don't you take a look real quick at these and see which one you'd like to adopt as yours.
Judge Sullivan, I have to admit I didn't bring copies of all those.
We've got them.
Oh, thank you.
Our trusty staff person is way on top of it.
Goodness. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, sir. So why don't you take a look.
End of the table.
We kind of had them in priority, too, but let's not worry about that right now. Just pick one that you think you'd like to work on.
That's sort of
well, that's true.
You don't have to fight
with these.
Right. And they do lend themselves to. Okay, shall we go first come, first serve? And
I have just a question. Uh-huh. I didn't count, but I think there are about seven.
I don't have any expertise.
So it may be that not everybody does one.
Oh, or that there are more than one person works.
There are eight. Well, everybody's going to work on them, because if you don't have one that you're the lead on, you still have got to fill in your stuff for in your discipline. So everybody will be working on them. I'm looking for people who take the lead to get it done. So,
Madam Chairman, I'll start out and volunteer adequate supply of quality representation for all parties.
Okay. All right. So that's Judge Well.
And, Chairman, I'd be happy to take improve front end dependency case management.
Okay. Front end. Lori Fellows.
Okay. Both sides.
Which one? Sure.
Joanne and I will share the provision of appropriate legal services in a timely manner.
Okay, I think that's a real good idea to share that one, because that's where we're really honing in.
Who are you sharing it with?
Joanne.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We can have, you'll be represented. Your lawyer will be on this.
Madam Chairman, I'll do the reducing unnecessary time in foster care.
Okay.
Or if you prefer, I can do the ICPC one.
Oh, that's fine.
ICPC doesn't start its mission.
That was. I'm going to make sure I get the names right. Are you getting them?
Yeah, I'm getting them too.
Okay.
I would be glad to do the training for all participants in the process.
Okay. That's your favorite one, isn't it? Okay.
So. I think maybe that would be a good one for me to team with you.
Sure.
Okay.
And I wonder if I would also should be on the adequate supply of quality representation with Welch.
You guys want to do that as a threesome? Kind of up to you.
Adequate supply.
Oh, with Betsy. Yeah. Okay. Are you good with that, Judge Welch?
Oh, sure.
Okay. All right. Now that leaves social services. Okay, I can take. I'll take the prioritize the court the scheduling one.
So Judge Love, do that with you?
Yeah. Why don't we do that?
I am happy to do that one.
Okay. And that. Should we put the I wonder if we ought to put the ICPC one with the training, or is that really what we've got is provision of social services in a timely manner. Is there somebody that wants to take that one?
I thought someone did take that one. Wasn't that what you and Angela, that which one did you take?
Lawyers.
Okay, I'll take this one.
Okay. And then that leaves the ICPC.
That's what I do.
No. That one's kind of an orphan, isn't it?
You know, I just I have people in my office who will take this one.
Okay. And if you want me to help on that, I'll.
Okay.
Because that's kind of. Okay, and then what we're going to do, I'm going to ask Leola to set up like a email tree for to make sure everybody has everybody's email so you can communicate that way. Or do we have we all done that? Do we all have everybody's emails?
I think we're all on the notices we've been
getting. Okay, so we can do that. So that'll be the main way we do that. And then on all of them, what you're tasked with doing is filling out your portion and getting it to the lead people. And we'll send that out by email so that we all know who to go to. Will that work?
Yeah, can I ask a couple of process questions? Mm-hmm.
So when we send our individual comments to the lead person or people, mm-hmm. Do we need to CC everyone, or can we just send them to the lead and the lead will compile everything and send it out to everyone for review?
I'd say just send to the lead for the starts. That way you can be working on them. And let's set a deadline for getting that done about a month out so that we've got plenty of time before the next meeting to get a version for the next meeting and get it to everybody. So let me get a calendar.
Can I ask one more question? Uh-huh. And I'm just not sure what we're putting on this, because our legislation that created this work group said that we're going to create these interdisciplinary plans of things that we can do now with existing resources, with existing legislation. So is that kind of what we're putting on these at this point?
Yeah.
That first step?
Okay. Why don't you sent me that email that had the four mandates, so why don't you, let's send that out to everybody again, and we want to focus on that mandate. Okay, is everybody clear on that? And we'll have those in front of you when you're filling it out, because there's lots of, we don't want just, last time we did that, we had kind of a brainstorming, free range, whatever, but now we've got to really focus on our legislative tasks.
Madam Chair, and Leola, remind me if I'm misremembering, we're to look at things that we can do within existing resources and existing statutory framework, what we could do with a change in statutes that wouldn't cost any extra money, what we could do with extra money.
Right.
It seems to me, if while we're at it, mm-hmm. we might as well do all three as we send things in, because otherwise it's just going to take a long time and we're going to rethink things. So, I mean, if I were on looking at almost any of them, I would probably have difficulty keeping myself.
within existing.
Right. Do you think that it might, maybe what we ought to do is do one sheet for each one of those?
That'd be great. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So,
or work for the organizers,
so we,
but I think
we'll have, and then that way they'll be organized that way too. Okay. And then, how about if we set a deadline of Valentine's Day, the 14th of February, to get all everybody to get their materials to their leads? Is that, or should I set it shorter? That's a full month.
Please don't set it shorter.
Okay. All right. And then let's set a, and our next meeting is it March 14th? Is that when our next meeting is? Or is it the 7th? The 14th. Okay, so can we have, we need to get these to Mike so that he can get them out for everybody to see at a reasonable time. Would the 7th work for you? That'd be a week before.
Sure.
With the understanding that they're going to be in draft form and we're going to work on them at the session. So it'll be whatever you want us to have. We don't expect a beautiful polished thing at that point, but something that's at least organized so we can discuss it as a group. And then our next meeting will then be the work session on those documents. Does that sound good? Okay, anything else we need?
I'm sorry, I missed who had improved fund independency case management. Okay.
And we'll get that out to everybody. Okay, anything else on those? If not, we can move to our, I appreciate everybody's willingness to work on that because I think this is going to be a really exciting thing when we get this organized and get it, start writing some things. And to give us some ideas on an area that we're really excited about, we'll move now to the Washington State's Parents Representation Program. I hope you all had a chance to look at the executive summaries. They were very, very interesting. And I've got a lot of questions after I read them for Mr. Ballou. And I'd like to introduce Brent Ballou, the managing attorney. And I'll turn it over to him to begin his presentation. And I'm sure we're going to have a lot of questions for you in the end.
Fantastic. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Brent Ballou. I'm one of the managing attorneys with the Washington State Office of Public Defense. And I get to talk to you today about what we've been able to achieve by lowering caseloads for attorneys representing parents, which happens to be a personal story for me, too. So, because I was a big part of, I was one of the contractors who did this work for a long time. Just to kind of let you know a little bit about our office and how our office may be different from your office, we're actually pretty small. Most public defense is still handled by the counties, although we have 39 counties in Washington. Where our programs are with appellate, we contract all the attorneys who provide the appellate defense. And then in two-thirds of the counties, we contract with the attorneys who represent parents. And then we also provide the statewide contracts for people who represent people who have been accused of being sexually violent predators. So that's our office. We're really small. There's only about 14 of us in our office. Our program started because there was a report to our legislature about the poor state of representation for parents in these cases. When I say this is personal for me, I started doing dependency in 1996. I was pretty much just out of law school, happened to be down at the juvenile courthouse and didn't even know what a dependency was. And the judge says, I need a body. It's you. And next thing I knew, I had 100 dependency cases. And then I also, on top of a felony caseload that usually included a very serious a murder or a sex offense. And then I also had a misdemeanor caseload, and I also did appeals. And that's what someone had to do if they wanted to be able to make a living doing public defense in our state. And what that created was courthouse representation for parents. And what I mean by that is that you only saw your attorney on the steps of the courthouse, and you got the case plan the same day as court. You go through it with your client, have you read it? Do you understand it? Do you agree? Great, you agree. We can sign off on this, and we'll get you on your way, and I'll see you again in 6 months. Or, oh, you don't agree? Okay, well, we're going to need to continue this case so we can talk about this and figure out where we go from here, and then we'd come back in a couple of weeks, and hopefully we'd had a chance to talk before for the next day at the courthouse, but usually it wasn't. Usually the next time they came to court 2 weeks later, we were able to hash it out. And you can probably imagine that has a tendency to slow these cases down, and it isn't exactly what parents deserve in these cases. So my story was typical. That's what was reported to the legislature. So we were allowed to start a pilot program in three counties. It was Benton Franklin, that's one judicial district, so it was kind of like one county, and then Pierce County. In 2005, we expanded the first expansion, and I was a part of that. Through 2007, we expanded to two-thirds of the state, and then we get to expand a little bit further here in July. We're already starting working on that. So the pilot program reduced the caseloads, added more attorneys, also provided a social worker and added the providing for expert funds. What was going on in those counties was that if you wanted expert services, you're going to have to ask the court, and it was usually, you know, the courts were pretty reluctant to give you kind of what you needed for expert services. So most attorneys actually just didn't bother. The pilot was evaluated a number of times, and one of the good things that came out of that was when you lower caseloads and allow attorneys the time they need to work these cases properly, how should they be spending their time? And that's how we came up with the number of about a third of attorneys' time should be spent on client communication. About half of their time is case preparation, and only about 20% in court. And the description I gave you of what it was like before, you can see how it was probably almost, it would have been reversed, right? It would have been a lot more court, very little client communication, and very little preparation. So the foundation of our program is we have standards, and I'm going to go through those standards, but none of this is possible without eliminating the caseload. And so we limit to 80 cases per full-time attorney. Our definition of a case is largely, it's basically a parent. A parent is a case, no matter how many children they have. They can count an additional case if a termination petition is filed or a guardianship petition is filed. So sometimes a parent will count for two cases, but for the most part, it's one. With the number of terminations filed, I think it's usually about 60. It depends on the county. Different counties will have different filing rates for termination petitions, but for the most part, it would be about 60 families or 60 parents would be on your caseload. So with that, we were able to implement standards of representation. And so what I'm going to go through here is all the things that we expect of our attorneys. We have standards that are they are on our website. It's a part of their contractual obligation to us is to follow these standards. The hallmark of that is client communication. Again, about a third of attorneys' time should be spent on client communication. The only exception to that is we have some attorneys who spend a lot of time on preparation, more than normal. So usually when we review that and we see that, we understand that their client communication hours might dip to about a quarter, but that's because they're also really, really prepared. So. And we know who those attorneys are. So client communication, attorneys need to be available. Obviously I wasn't available when I had my horrible caseloads, but I saw it instantly. As soon as I became a contractor with the Office of Public Defense and my caseload, I got rid of 20 dependency cases and the rest of my caseload, I was able to spend time with my clients, meet with them in my office. Spend hours with them in my office, and particularly establishing a good 2 to 3 hour meeting at the very beginning was the start of a good productive relationship. We're talking about best interests of children, very private personal matters. And it's just crucial for you to be able to have a good relationship that's a little bit different, I think, from a criminal law. Public defense perspective. You're part social worker. You have to be part social worker. And so in order for you to be able to get your client engaged in services, be able to get them to engage in an honest way about the best interest of their children, you really need to be able to spend time with them. So you need to be able to accommodate their needs as well. Parents come to these cases with different backgrounds and different needs. You may have cultural issues. You may have domestic violence issues. You're probably going to have substance abuse issues. You may have language issues. We provide for interpreters in the attorney's office, and that allows them to develop those meaningful relationships even when people don't speak English. Advocacy for services is a big part of our standards. This is a part of holding the department accountable for reasonable efforts. We want this advocacy to occur at every stage of the proceeding, from shelter care hearing right on through the termination trial. Our attorneys should be making sure that their parents are getting the services that their parents need, and only the services their parents need. We want to make sure that these service plans are narrowly tailored for the exact needs of the family and of that parent. We definitely emphasize early engagement. Most of these cases, almost all of these cases, it is beneficial for the parents to get engaged immediately after shelter care and services. There's some exceptions to this. There's times when maybe a parent isn't ready. There may be some legal issues where maybe it's not beneficial to have your client doing an assessment right away. But for the most part, we encourage and our attorneys encourage their clients to get engaged in services as quickly as possible. The services should be coordinated so that they're doable. We should have, occasionally you load a parent down with services, and it turns out that they've got to be in one place in one part of town at one time, and they're supposed to be at another place at the exact same time. So our attorneys should be very involved in making sure that that's not happening, that these are achievable service plans. They need to make sure that they're involved and their client is involved in the development of that service plan, so that helps it be narrowly tailored. Visitation, as far as we're concerned, visitation is about the most important thing that should be happening in these cases. These are the best predictors of whether a family is going to be able to reunify. They're also really good predictors of how a child's going to do, even if it's going to result in a termination. There's studies out there that indicate that frequent visitation helps that transition into a new family. So by statute, visitation is a right of the family in the state of Washington, and it can't be limited as a sanction. You can't, if a parent's not engaged in their service plan, you can't say, now you can't have visits until you're engaged in your service plan. That's what that means. It should be the maximum visitation that's developmentally appropriate for the child. We know that infants and toddlers need a lot more visitation than older children do. So visitation plan should take that into account. And I will tell you that this is a uphill battle depending on what county you're in. There are some counties where infants and toddlers are getting 4 to 5 visits per week, and there's places where all children are getting 1 2-hour visit per week. Definitely want our attorneys advocating for visitation at every possible moment. And the other issues around visitation are, well, should it be supervised, monitored, or unsupervised? I think the default has always been, well, it's supervised and good. And then, oh, maybe we're going to have a we're going to return this family. Well, I guess now we're just returning the child. Our attorneys need to be mindful of that. They need to work on supervised visits when it's appropriate. When it's not appropriate, let's move these to monitored or unsupervised. Our attorney should be advocating for sibling visitation where it's appropriate. And address any barriers to visitation. I know money is sometimes an issue. Sometimes workload is an issue for getting people to visits. So the attorney should be assisting on finding other solutions to that. Is there a relative? Is there a friend? We call them suitable others that can supervise visitation. So one of our standards is that the attorneys are intimately involved in making sure that visitations are happening. Of course, attorneys should be prepared. Now, I think one of the things that when I'm explaining this to people who don't understand the legal system in general, not you guys obviously do, but it's just that these are all things that if you were paying for an attorney, if you went out and hired an attorney, these are all things that you would want your attorney to be doing, and it just isn't any different than that. So attorneys obviously need to be prepared. They need to do their own independent investigations. We expect them to use experts where it's appropriate. We expect them to use the OPD social workers where it's appropriate. And then obviously making court motions and any appropriate motion and be prepared to argue those in court. One area that particularly with court steps representation is you're not with your client at a case conference or at any staffings, and we expect our attorneys to participate in those. Those are great collaborative times to be finding solutions on moving these cases forward. So we definitely expect our attorneys to be a part of that. So I mentioned that we have social workers. Our social workers have the same qualifications as the state social workers. Many of them actually worked for the department. Our social services manager actually worked for the department, was a supervisor, was an area administrator for 20 years with the department. We are able to attract social workers from the department because our social workers don't have any paperwork. and so they're able to do what social workers want to do, right? Practice street social work. They are a limited resource. Unfortunately, we're not able to provide one for every case. It's one full-time social worker for every four full-time attorneys. So our attorneys do have to be selective. I think primarily they will get social workers involved where maybe a parent that needs a little extra hand-holding, maybe a parent who has some trust issues, definitely doesn't trust the department social worker. Maybe someone who wants to call their attorney four times a day. Maybe they'll get a social worker involved there that can, like I said, do a little more hand-holding. Our social workers have also are really adept at finding services in times where maybe the department isn't able to. They're not constrained by contracts or that sort of thing. They can think a little bit more outside the box. I know that they've, there's always some initial trepidation by the department social workers when an OPD social worker comes in because, wow, is this someone that's going to come and tell me how to do my job or tell me how I'm not doing my job? And our social workers work very hard to not do that. Their job is to come in and help. And I knew it was working. I was fortunate enough to have one of the first OPD social workers, and I knew that was working when I got a phone call from the department social worker one day saying, I am just not able to reach this parent. Could you get Mark involved? Absolutely, we'll get Mark involved. So it's been nice to see how they've become a part of the team where maybe in the middle of a hearing, the judge will say, OPD social worker, right? You've been working this case. What do you think? That was a first time we heard about that happening, and now it happens very often. That was a pretty good day. I know one of our social workers in Spokane has become the go-to person on housing in that county. She's magical finding housing for people. So, and that's everyone. The department social workers will call her for to help out with housing. So. So their role is pretty similar to what the department social worker should be doing, but comes with the bent of being able to be an advocate. So, right, so they're going to help them understand their case plan, help them to have a say in their case. Again, the early engagement is crucial for these cases, and to help them take ownership of their cases. Okay, so how do we make sure all these things happen? So first and foremost, our office provides training, and we provide lots and lots of training. We've had to be creative in tough budgetary times. Our office, going through the recession, did experience cuts, but we didn't cut with services. So we had to be a little more I learned that coffee is a constitutionally mandated service, apparently, out of training. The first time that we didn't provide food because it wasn't constitutionally mandated, coffee is. And the training takes a couple different forms. One is we held statewide conferences, and those are really important. The first one that was done by OPD was in 2004 before the expansion, so it was still in the pilot phase. Our office brought everybody together, and that training is still talked about by I know that was a big day for me. It was the it is so lonely doing these cases in a small county, and I was in a small county. It's an area of law that most attorneys really don't have much of a clue about. It's an area of law that operates differently than other areas of law, and so you really feel like you're kind of alone. And so having that training, that first statewide training, and realizing that I wasn't alone, that there are other people facing the same problems that I was facing, and that we all had different solutions and could help one another, well, that was big. And like I said, that training is still talked about. So we try to do one of those a year. There's a couple years where we weren't able to get everybody together, so we made them regional, and we went to them. We had four or five different regional trainings. We'll come up with little topics and go out to each county so that we can meet with just that local section too, because I have the small, intimate training, so you really you can really get down to the issues. But you can also just get a flavor for what's going on in that county and how the attorneys practice in that county. There's two other managing attorneys, and I mentioned we have our social, so there's four of us in our office, and our absolute most favorite thing to do is the technical assistance. We all secretly still want to be in the field, and so this is our connection. Our attorneys will contact us with a problem that they might have, and fortunately for us, we have the time and the connections to know about some things that they may not know about. I know one that recently came up was one of our managing attorneys is really interested in infant and toddler issues, and had learned that there was some federal dollars, some Part C federal dollars that really just aren't used, even though they are allowed to be used for children who've been abused or neglected and used outside the dependency process. And so he's now taking that on the road and able to share that, and hopefully that provides some. You know, when people say, well, we don't have the budget for that, well, have you tried this funding stream? So we have the time to find those issues and bring them to attorneys, and I think that really improves the practice. Of course, we monitor caseloads. We want to make sure that most of our attorneys are not full-time work. They have part-time contracts. So if they're a half-time contractor and have a 40-case caseload, we make sure that they stay at their 40 cases. And then we also monitor their outside caseload, because we do, our caseload standards mean that they are that they should not have more than a full-time public defense caseload of anything, if they're, you know, their child representation, the juvenile offender, whatever it is. Of course, we monitor the hours they spend on their cases. We do this through our database. They report to us on a monthly basis. And then we keep close track of those client communication hours, making sure that they're spending at least about a third of their time. We have a complaint process that is mostly informal. Most of the time, it's parents who are in a panic. Termination petition's been filed. I don't think my attorney's on my side. Can you help? And we'll talk to them about the issues. We'll talk to the attorney. Most of the time, we're able to repair whatever. Whatever problem there is in a formal basis. And then every 2 years, we conduct attorney reviews. We try to observe our attorneys in court once a year. When we do our reviews, we go out. We actually go out and sit down with them for about 45 minutes each. And we have 125 attorney contractors currently. And so we'll go out, we'll sit with them, and we'll go through their caseload, go through client communication hours. We'll ask for a written example of their work. We'll have the opportunity to talk to them a little bit about philosophy. If you just have a conversation with an attorney, you have a pretty good idea of what their philosophy of practice is, what it is that they're doing to help their clients. Those things have helped us do, I think, a very good job of finding those attorneys who just aren't suited to this practice. And then when we find those attorneys, we don't renew their contracts or we terminate those contracts. We haven't had to do that very much, but we know that our level of practice. We've been talking in our office that one way we could improve the child welfare system is if the department put some people on a committee, and we had people on a committee, and we just got to pick the people that we didn't think from the other side that were doing very, very well. We could just eliminate everybody that way, and improve the system vastly. Of course, that never worked, but yeah. So impacts. Has it worked? And how do we know that it's worked? I will say that I think we can demonstrate we've had better outcomes for children, better outcomes for families, and then, of course, better fiscal outcomes for the state, which has allowed us to maintain this program and expand. And so how do we know that? We've been evaluated a number of times. The most recent ones, we did this with the help of the Washington State Center for Court Research. This was a reunification study. It was just looking at numbers of children reunified. And we looked at a pre-program time frame and a post-program time frame. And in the OPE counties, you can see that there was a pretty significant increase in the reunification rate. And then we looked at the non-OPD counties during the same time frames, and they actually had a slight decrease in their reunification rates. And the question they're always asked is, well, okay, are those safe? And they are safe. We looked at reentries, actually refilings of dependencies, and there was a slight improvement in OPD counties. It's not a statistically significant one, so I could say they were safer reunifications, but they certainly weren't less safe. So obviously we're very proud of that. And about the same time that we were working on that, Partners for Our Children at the University of Washington, at the time was headed by Mark Courtney. And some of you may know that, I mean, when you're talking about Mark Courtney, you're talking about one of the best child welfare researchers in the country. He's now at the University of Chicago. This study that he did with Partners has actually been published in Children and Youth Services Review. And he had heard about our program. He had talked to folks in the field, and, well, what happens with enhanced parents' representation? Well, of course, social workers and assistant attorney generals who weren't as enamored with us said, well, gosh, you know, you give attorneys more money and more time on their hands, and they just bog the system down. They make it run slower. They make our jobs harder. They're always getting in our way. And they're always asking for continuances, and it's just slowing things down. So he decided to study that. And what he found is that wasn't true at all. What he found was when there was a reunification, those reunifications happened about a month sooner. And this was the surprising one. When the permanency outcome was adoption or guardianship, those happened about a year sooner. And so you can see the impact that might have on a child welfare system when the cases are actually moving faster. And I think our best analogy about that is the car analogy. If parents rep was the, you know, if you think of each tire as a player, parents representation before the parents representation program had a flat tire and the car just couldn't go. It wasn't as efficient. And now that all the tires are inflated, the system works much better. And so you can kind of see in our licensed foster care numbers have gone down drastically since 2007. We can't take credit for all of that. There's initiatives from the department to reduce that caseload as well. But a part of that is certainly ours. And I think the way that we figure it is about 300 children go home that ordinarily wouldn't have as a result of our program. So we know we've impacted our licensed foster care caseload, and with great savings for the state. That's what I have. I know we have a lot more time, and hopefully you have questions.
We do.
Can you explain how children are represented in Washington State?
Oh, yes. Not well.
But it's a whole different system.
It is. That is actually the big topic this legislative session has been for the last couple legislative sessions. In general, children are not represented other than by ACASA, so it's a best interest representation. But if you're talking about a stated interest or a legal interest representation, with the exception of a few counties in Washington, it's not happening. A couple counties, it's happening after the age of 12. Columbia, Garfield, and Soton counties, there's one judge who appoints at birth, and that's kind of gone away in one of his counties, so it doesn't happen very often.
Okay. Well, to follow that up, do your attorneys, do some of them have combined caseloads? I guess they're not representing children, but are they representing people in criminal and delinquency and stuff too?
Yes. Actually, I mentioned one of the counties where there is children representation. Some of them actually do represent kids. Some of them are attorney guardian litems in those counties that have attorney guardian litems. Some of them do criminal or juvenile offender work as well.
How do you figure the caseloads in those situations?
So our Supreme Court has adopted caseload standards now. Mm-hmm. So we just count them up.
So you have standards basically for everything, and you make sure they're within standards of whatever they're doing.
Yeah, the way that it works now is not in dependency cases, but in juvenile offender and criminal cases, the attorneys have to certify with the court on a, I think it's a quarterly basis, that they're within caseload standards.
On the attorneys that do both criminal work and this work, do you have any feel for how they compare to attorneys who are doing this work exclusively?
In terms of workload or in terms of philosophy?
Philosophy.
In philosophy. I was one of those attorneys, and there's lots of criminal public defender types that believe in more of a holistic approach to public defense. There's some, particularly the old guard, who have a little bit to learn. They're not as touchy-feely, but they do have the ability to use an OPD social worker. I think it also becomes very attractive to them once they realize that a dependent, one of the unique things about a dependency case is you have the ability to help your client make good facts. And in a criminal case, those facts were already happened. You can't change those, but in a dependency case, there's lots of ways you can help make a very good case. And if you're litigious and really care about winning a trial and create your own facts, I think those people come along pretty well.
And then my big question is, how are you funding all of this?
This is all, we fund this with state dollars.
Okay. Go ahead.
Judge, thank you. I assume by the reduction in the number of cases that each attorney handled, I assume that the costs went up to the state. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And my assumption is that by reducing foster care, and you mentioned probably in terminations by 350 or so, there was a savings to the
Correct.
State. How do the two balance out?
We more than pay for ourselves. I think it takes like 3 or 4 years, after that amount of time, the amount of savings to the state more than pays for the cost of the program.
Thank you. One final question. How did it benefit the kids involved?
Well, so obviously with reductions in the length of time in foster care, you're definitely going to see an improvement. You're going to have fewer placements. And just the fact of spending less time in foster care, I think, has been demonstrated to be better for children. But also with increased reunifications, you're keeping families together. And we definitely have a philosophy that where possible, families should stay together, and that's what's best for children.
One further question. My assumption is that keeping the kid in the family is beneficial to the kid. Is
Correct.
That? And that's backed up by research?
I think there's some disagreement about that. Mm-hmm. I think that some of the child welfare research is there's some that say yes and some that say no. We tend to believe that yes, and it's a part of our statutory philosophy too. I mean, in statute, we're supposed to reunite families where possible.
Thank you.
Go ahead. We'll just go down the line here. Judge Wells, why don't you go next? And then.
Okay. Do you have second shelter hearings in any of the courts where your program is operating?
Kind of. So we start with our first shelter care hearing has to happen within 72 hours mm-hmm. of removal. There is a shelter care review 30 days later. Generally, that review is just looking at, has there been a change in circumstances since the prior shelter care hearing? So a little bit of it depends on the jurisdiction. Some of those are a little more robust than others.
Second shelter hearings generally happen sooner than 30 days nationally. It's more like a week or two after the first one to make sure that particularly in sort of marginal cases, that things... So is that not happening? Or is that not
happening, but I think it happens in a different way. you know, if the attorney has the chance to evaluate the case, they may set over the shelter care hearing a week or two. Obviously, you're going to agree to shelter care initially and then have a hearing in a week or two to address any issues. There's lots of issues that need to be covered in our state in a shelter care hearing, not just whether there's reasonable cause for removal, but we need to be talking about placement and visitation and services can't be ordered unless they're agreed to. But
can I ask a couple more questions, or
yeah,
should I
no,
take
go
turns
ahead.
Like a good
no, go ahead.
Talk about pretrial conferences, settlement conferences. Do you have those in dependency
for the most part?
Case?
No, and you're talking about dependencies and not terminations.
Yeah.
For the most part, we don't have those. I think it's a judicial resource problem. Mm-hmm. There will be pretrial conferences. We do have case conferences that get set. The judicial officer is not involved in those, but they are an opportunity to figure out the case plan and figure out and resolve issues. A lot of courts have some local rules around making sure that we're only having a hearing about issues we need to have a hearing about. So they can weed out the things that they already agree to.
You know, you wouldn't be doing this yourselves, but I'm curious how in your jurisdiction the absent parent problem at the front end of a dependency case is. Is there anything being done, you know, new and different or creative to address that? You know, it's a big, big issue in all of this.
Parents that don't end up appearing, or
well, that you don't know where they necessarily know where they are, or you, missing parents, basically.
This is a little bit outside, just because. But I am aware that our department has some programs. There's some focus on that. They actually have some fatherhood program people at headquarters, but that are trying to address that problem.
Thanks.
It's a family finding issue. Sorry.
I had just a couple of questions around the finances. Do you know what the annual budget is for this representation?
Yeah, so it's $16 million a year.
$12 million. And do you know what the cost of a year of foster care in Washington is?
For a year? So OFM figured out that it was about $853 per month.
Okay. And do you know if the states managed to make a federal match with any of the funds they're using to support this program?
For our program?
Yeah.
No.
There is
all state dollars for our program.
And then I assume that you all continue to represent parents until the proceeding is dismissed, not just getting kids out of care, but actually till the termination of the case. So
correct.
They'll be in-home cases as well as foster care cases.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Do you know what percentage of children are represented by CASA or where CASA is appointed?
I don't know. I don't know the exact number. I will say that just about every county has a CASA program.
But would each child be appointed a CASA automatically, or?
It's mixed. There are places where some get a CASA, some get an attorney guardian litem. Everyone has to be represented by something like that. Every child does.
Okay. And then the social worker that's working with the attorney, mm-hmm. are they monitoring and looking at children's services as well, or is that for someone else that's involved in the case aside from the DHS caseworker?
What do you mean by monitoring?
So are they helping to ensure children have access to services that they might need specifically?
They're going to be focused on the parent.
On the parent. Okay.
Yeah.
And then do you think that parents are more likely to engage in services, more services or less services as a result of having this type of representation?
I'll say better services.
Okay.
So right, we need to make sure that, yeah, more specific, narrowly tailored to the parent.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I ask one last as
yeah.
it goes back down the other way?
Okay.
I'm sorry. The $853 a month is the maintenance cost. Do you have any idea what the administrative cost is to the department?
I don't.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go the other direction.
So you talked about the increase in reunification for the counties that had your program. Did anybody track, let's say, reunification cases dismissed. Mm-hmm. Anybody track new petitions filed on the same family after that?
Yes, we did. We did look at that.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. And so in our counties, there actually was a slight improvement. There were fewer refiled cases. It wasn't statistically significant, so that's where I can say I know they weren't less safe.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay.
Can you tell us how the agency is represented in Washington State, and if they typically have case attorneys in court?
They do, and in almost all the counties, it is an assistant attorney general who represents the state. There are a few counties where the attorney general's office contracts with the local prosecuting attorney to do that.
But the attorney is in the court for every court proceeding?
Correct.
Go ahead.
If you're not having pretrial conferences, how do you go about, what's the time frame in terms of whether your client makes an admission or the case goes to trial? How long is that taking?
So there will be pretrial conferences. I was more focused on the settlement conference portion of that. Our pretrial conference is essentially showing up in court and saying, is this going to go to trial or not, and have all the discovery issues been met.
And approximately how long is it taking to resolve dependency petitions in your various counties?
So within 75 days.
And were there any studies as to whether that's gone quicker under this representation program or it's taking longer to resolve petitions?
Not program specific. The Center for Court Research has to produce a report each year on the timeliness of dependency cases, whether you're meeting the 75 days, whether you're meeting permanency planning hearings within a year, whether you're meeting time frames for filing of termination petitions. So we have data on all of that.
Do you have data as to whether this has led to the smaller caseloads and the representation has led to more trials or more admissions?
We don't.
Okay. Go ahead.
Major? I have two questions. One is continuing to follow up on Lois's further follow-up on the 853 figure. I want to make sure that I understand what it doesn't include. It doesn't include the cost to the state of the salary and benefits of the DHS DCFS worker, correct?
I'm actually not certain on that. I don't know that.
The average monthly board amount?
It's been a while since I looked at this. I remember the figure. It's in an OFM report.
Let's try and get some other things it doesn't include. Doesn't include judge time?
No.
Doesn't include attorney time?
No.
Doesn't include your social worker time?
No. No, it's this is what it costs the department.
Okay, but still unclear whether it costs that. I mean, it's a low figure in my book.
In Oregon, the overall cost of a year of foster care is $29,000, of which approximately $9,000 is maintenance to keep the child in the home.
And by these figures, it would be that just grossly the cost of foster care in Washington would be $40,000 a year. That includes the department's time, of which approximately $10,000 is the maintenance payment. And those are just gross figures. But to meet your budget of 300 kids, it has to cost $40,000 a year to have a child in care, to have a cost savings, if you include the department's cost. But at 300 kids and a $12 million budget, how did you save the state money? I'm sorry, I went on.
No. I think it's a critical piece of information that we need to get. We may not be able to do it right now, but we need to get it nailed down.
I don't think I can answer those questions, but at this time. But yeah, we could get that information to you.
Thank you.
My second question is: how do you monitor the non-parent representation caseloads of attorneys who are part-time, whose other time is not either criminal or juvenile defense, such that they're required to report their caseload?
So we do have access to our judicial information system, which will tell us the notice we can find notices of appearance that have been entered by those attorneys. And we've had a couple of occasions where we've found an attorney who had way too many cases.
Civil cases.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process of collaboration in Washington in terms of how the program started and how the collaborative pieces either, you know, what they were at the initial start and where they are now?
Yeah, it's been quite a sea change. I mean, think at the start, when you would have a task force or commission on any child welfare issue, a parent's voice was never represented. And we had to kick and fight and scratch and say, hey, you need to, we're here. We want to be included. And what's different today is now we don't have to do that. We're always included. And we have a very good relationship with the Attorney General's office. We have a very good relationship with the department. One illustration of that is the last time they rolled out, they called it the Child Safety Framework, which was some definitions on helping to assess safety for social workers. They came and trained our attorneys on it so that our attorneys would know exactly what definitions. So they could all speak the same language, essentially. I think that's one of the things that there's been lots of trainings around our state, both on a regional level and a local level on roles and responsibilities. There's a recognition that a high turnover rate, and there's actually a study, a high turnover rate of line social workers has a lot to do with court and going to court. And social worker ethics being different than attorney ethics and people not really understanding that. And so we've definitely spent a lot of time making sure that everybody understands what each other's roles are and how our ethics might be different, how we might come to different conclusions, and how at the end of the day, every person in the courtroom is really interested in the best interest of that child. They're just coming at it from a different frame of reference or a different point of view. And that's okay. And so it's really nice, and it's now extended to the point where when you see in legislation a new task force being created, not only are we included, but veteran parents are included as well. Just and that's not without anyone having to ask for it. It just now happens, and so it's definitely made for lots of improvements to our system, I believe.
And then, when you mentioned interdisciplinary trainings, do you have a set work group that helps create the agendas for those interdisciplinary trainings? How do you make sure that each county gets the right set of interdisciplinary training and agenda?
We have three mechanisms for that. So one is we have a Children's Justice Conference that's held every year, and that's a statewide interdisciplinary conference that usually about 2,000 people attend each year, coming from all parts of the child welfare system. We have what's called the Reasonable Effort Symposium that's now put on using CIP money through the Court Improvement Training Academy out of the University of Washington. They bring in speakers and hold, most of those are regional trainings. Well, the Reasonable Effort Symposiums are all regional trainings. They also provide other trainings and have online trainings as well. When we're bringing in a new contractor, not only am I giving them access to all of our resources and our training materials, I'm giving them access to the Court Improvement Training Academy's resources. I said there are three. I mentioned the Children's Justice and Reasonable Effort Symposiums. I guess there's two.
And sorry if I can. No. How did you work with providers? You mentioned that initially, and this may have been a comment in your presentation or one that you and I spoke about earlier, but that initially some providers felt a little bit threatened because their livelihood was really structured upon a high caseload and so that they could make ends meet. I'm wondering how that transition was made between high caseloads and a reduced caseload. Was it just the additional funding?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah, so you're talking about the attorneys.
Yeah.
And for us, it was easy because we're bringing more money. For my personal experience, I got to eliminate those 20 dependency cases and the rest of my caseload, and I actually had a slight increase in my pay as a result.
I think, and that kind of ties in, the question that I had was that, how, it's a flat fee, is that correct? So you get a certain dollar amount per case?
No.
No, okay.
So we pay for the caseload, And then there's a, so a full-time attorney carrying an 80-case caseload, we're going to pay them somewhere between $102,000 to $122,400, depending on their experience. And they'll just get a flat monthly stipend for that amount, right, to carry that particular caseload.
And did it require, I mean, as part of the initial training and rollout that, I mean, I would think there would be some incentive and disincentive, depending on the attorney, for if you're getting a flat fee for no matter how much work you do on the case. So I know the goal would be to reduce caseloads to do more work. Was there a way to track?
So we hold them accountable. We track their hours. And we make sure that they're putting in the right number of hours. Our part-time contractors, and this is something we've had to be really mindful of, most of our part-time contractors actually put in more than what we would expect. Some of them are even putting in full-time hours because they are so dedicated to these cases. So one thing that we do have in place for that is we have an extraordinary compensation policy so that when a contractor's got one of those cases, just, maybe a term trial that lasts a week and means that they're not able to attend to the rest of their practice, they're able to ask us for more funds. Now, those funds, out of those funds, they have to pay their own administrative costs, and they don't have any benefits or anything like that. So they're not making $100,000 or $122,000, right. But, yeah.
And is the social worker paid, is that part of that, or is that paid, the social worker's paid above this?
We contract with the social workers. So the attorney does not have to pay for that.
And then is the social worker considered kind of like an agent of the parent's attorney?
Correct.
Is that how it works, like an investigator kind of?
Kind of.
Yeah.
The only issue, and it's one that we've worried about a lot, but has not really come up, is the issue of whether they're a mandated reporter.
That's where I was going, yeah.
Yeah. The reason why it doesn't come up is they're usually not in a position to have to report anything that they would be required to report. Our training around that is centered around the attorneys are independent contractors, so and it's their bar card that's at stake. So they need to be having those conversations with a social worker, making sure that whatever it is that they're comfortable with in doing, they don't put the social worker in that position.
And then are they allowed to assist with, you know, visitation resources are scarce everywhere, and it could be seen, I would imagine, as a person that could assist with visits, and I'm wondering if there's a line of you're not allowed to assist with actual provision of services as opposed to advice. That's correct.
They are not, so our social workers, and our expert service money is not used for things that the department is supposed to pay for. Or that they're legally required to pay for. So our social worker should not be the service provider for a visit. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't observe a visit. They will do that.
Right.
But they won't be the supervisor.
And then I just have kind of one last thing.
Oh, sorry.
What I'd like to do is take a break, maybe, and give him take about 10 minutes. And can you stay, Representative Krieger? So I want to give you a chance to ask questions if you have any. Are you good? All right. So let's take about 10 minutes, and then we'll keep going because I think everybody has more questions, and we'll give you a breather and we'll take about 10 minutes and start again at that quarter after.
We had taken the benefit of the break to get a little bit, but maybe I'll just hit one just for the benefit of all of us here. So I was talking about the number of practitioners that received this contract in Washington State, and it was how many?
About 125, which covers about 85 full FTEs. You know, if they're all full-time, there'd be about 85 people.
And about what percentage of the kids in care does that cover?
About two-thirds right now, about 6,700 children.
Really? Kind of low.
I have another question, if we can come back down to this.
Well, I'm going to let everybody get their first ones in, and then we'll start again. So are you?
And then the last one that was raised, too, was that so when the Attorney General's office represents, when they appear at juvenile hearings, they're representing a mixture maybe of DHS or
And the state of Washington.
And and the state of Washington Correct. Combined. They're not two separate parties.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's how it's supposed to be.
Thank you. And then I'm going to go to Representative Krieger.
Thank you. I appreciate being able to be here with all the ladies. I want kind of more of a statement than a question, maybe a couple questions. But when I came here 14 years ago, I had no idea I would get involved in this issue to the point that I have. And it's been an ongoing learning thing. But most of what I heard you talk about today wasn't surprising to my mind from what I've seen. Now, I went to Austin, Texas. I think you were with me. Austin, mm-hmm. Texas, October 15th of 2009 with Judge Brewer. I flew back there with him. And we talked, and he had a pile of briefs, and we were talking about dependency, and it was at the Chief Justice's symposium on dependency. And what we heard there was, hey, we don't have the dollars for, we're finding in most states, if they had proper representation early, a lot of these cases could be resolved, and the kids would either be gone into dependency, you know, into foster care until adoption or whatever. Mm-hmm. It would have happened much, much sooner. I think on your second slide, you mentioned mm-hmm. in Washington that visitation was more or less guaranteed, or it was expected that the parents would have visitation. I was on 5 or 6 sensitive review cases in Oregon. I probably had 40 or 50 where my experience and my staff and the other legislators are finding that there are those, what I call them, rogue caseworkers who kind of use that visitation as a lever to achieve other goals that are not in the best interest of the child. And that really bothers me when I find that, you know, about half the time they deny it, but yet it's in the reports and those types of things. Also, the brain science work that came out of Eugene, I'd never heard about before, but as soon as we heard that and we understood the impact of the removal in itself should really encourage us to do a lot more about not preventing that original removal by providing services immediately. And, of course, you talked about that, and others have been talking about that. And then the ability to have that representation, I said, just as soon as possible. You mentioned that your attorney general represents the department. But in our rural communities, about half the time, DHS acts as their own attorney in there, the caseworker. There's no DA in there doing that work. They present it to the judge. They're totally untrained and unqualified to be doing what they're doing. And we shouldn't be asking them to do it, in my mind. So it all gets back to the same thing. Where are our priorities about funding these programs? One, something in the neighborhood. I've heard all kinds of figures because I've chaired the judiciary 2 times. I've worked with, you know, Bill Taylor forever. Something like 60 or 70% of foster children end up in the criminal justice system. Why don't we make a better investment up front where we can make that difference? And it's not just dollars. How about the lives of those kids? I want attorneys for parents and kids as soon as we can. I want better training for our caseworkers and make them accountable also when they make mistakes. They got to understand that's not acceptable. I'm going to leave you here in a minute, but I really appreciate the fact that you've taken the time with the work that you've been doing to get to where you have, because what you're going to bring to us is going to help us make possibly better decision-making about policy things that we're going to be putting in statute. So I'm going to let you be. I don't think you have any questions for me, but for somebody who was a state police game warden for 28 years, finding out that she's from Vail, and I used to hunt at Harper. We learned a lot today. So,
yeah.
So thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
I'm going to run.
It means a lot. Okay, we'll start again. I guess I'll start since I was the first one. We've been kind of experimenting in my county with going in more with what we call taking legal only, not legal and physical. In other words, we filed a petition, but we haven't removed the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we appoint on everything, so that doesn't make any difference to get attorneys. Do you do that also?
So there will be cases that will start with a child in the home. We'll call it an in-home dependency.
Right.
So that that does happen. It's rare. Sometimes it'll happen at shelter care. If the attorneys are successful at shelter care, we'll continue with the in-home dependency. A few counties have experimented with extended shelter care. So they won't have a finding a dependency. They'll just provide some services and see if the problem can be resolved. And that a lot of times will happen with the
Well, in-home. What I'm thinking about, I guess, and I kind of like to get your thoughts on it, is a system like this where you had the attorneys and the social workers and you came in could probably really increase the number of situations where you were successful and never had removal. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. So we're not able to provide representation pre-filing.
But these, and I understand that, and we're not there yet either, but we are filing, but we're not removing. And then if you had this kind of aggressive approach with these people, you probably would never remove in a lot of these situations.
That's possible, for sure. Okay. I can tell you that just when I was a contractor, I made myself available to take phone calls when they were meeting with the parent pre-filing. And there were times when we were able to resolve the case and not have it filed.
And then what about the... I guess, what is the interplay between the investigator and the social worker? Has this eliminated the need for investigators, or they still have their roles to...
We don't use investigators, but for the most part.
Yeah.
Very, very rare.
Okay. So, and then how are you, I'm assuming that especially in some counties in Washington or just like mine, where you've got a large number of Hispanic families that are involved in the social welfare system, have you been able to find social workers and people, interpreters, that kind of thing? Has that been something you've struggled with? Or
we have struggled with it, and we're trying to get better at it. And having social workers who actually speak Spanish.
Yeah.
But the way we get around that is with interpreters, and we pay for those interpreters outside of court. So the department's responsible for providing the interpreter for meetings at the department. The court's responsible for the interpreters at court, and then we're responsible for the outside meetings.
What are your general things that your extraordinary expenses for? There'd be interpreters. What else?
It's pretty low, actually.
Yeah.
Surprisingly low.
Yeah, so you're not. Do you ever do independent evaluations and things like that with it? Sometimes
we do. Usually it's a second opinion evaluation. Occasionally, an attorney will want to have their own. I'll call it a clandestine evaluation.
Yeah.
Some work product.
Okay, so it's not to substitute for what the agency's required to, but it would. Sometimes you would have your own, and that would be something.
Correct.
Like. Anything else you can think of that you're using those funds for?
So we'll use them for the evaluations. We'll use them for occasionally an attorney will use them for a polygraph. If a parent has missed a UA, an attorney might and maybe they had a valid reason for missing the UA, the attorney might get their own UA or their own hair follicle. We use them for home studies. We use them a lot for home studies, particularly where the department just can't do it fast enough, or if it's going to be a potential out-of-state placement. We've sent social workers down to Mexico to do home studies.
Okay. That's what I was going to ask you, if you were using it on your international stuff.
Yeah. We'll also, instead of using one of the independent contractor social workers, we may hire as an expert what we'll call a forensic social worker. Mm-hmm. We have a stable of people who work for the department for 20, 30 years who know the policies and know the best practices. And they can sometimes take the more adversarial approach to a case. You know, these are the places where the department didn't follow its own policies, and I'm going to be an expert who can testify about that.
I have problems all the time with both Mexico and just across where, I'm on the border. You walk across the border, but I can't get home studies done in a timely way in another state, and my caseworkers can't go over there and do that. So your people wouldn't be limited that way. They could go do a home study.
Absolutely.
Quickly. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really interesting. Okay. I don't know the line.
Back to the beginning of the case. And I'm not looking for numbers here, just more of a characterization.
Mm-hmm.
Are kids returned at shelter hearings?
Generally, no.
Is it your sense that generally no or no?
Generally no. And so there's times where our attorneys are successful at a shelter care hearing, but they're still rare. And I would hope that they're rare, right? Because if the department's doing the job correctly, then they should be filing on those kids who should not be home.
I was a little taken aback by the fact you don't have any kind of pretrial procedures, court procedures. You don't, but the system doesn't. Are children placed back home or with extended family in the early stages of a case? I mean, let's say before the determination of jurisdiction. Are you able to get some kind of a more favorable result from your client's standpoint in the early stages of the case?
I have to think about that way. I mean, I think it depends on the county a little bit. And if we're talking with what I can tell you is that our return home rate within 15 months is greater than the non-program counties.
But you can't shorten. You don't have shorter intervals in there to make.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you tell me 6,700 kids in care in all of Washington?
That our program covers.
Oh, that your program. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know how many in-home?
How many of those are in-home at a given point? In-home.
So it's 6,700 kids total, not just kids in foster care.
I can't give you the in-home total.
Okay. I'm just picking at this a little bit because the cost savings is so different between in-home and in-care, but there's still a basic level of cost to the department to carry a case.
Right.
So that's the only reason I keep sort of picking at that.
I can give some of those numbers to Nancy.
Okay. Thank you. So should we maybe just submit to you, Nancy, a list of things we want to know about Washington?
Sure.
Okay.
That answers to you.
Thank you. I don't have any other questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Another question on there? About this way.
I have a question. Nancy. Could you just outline your court procedures? What is the timing?
Yeah.
And what are the titles of the different proceedings that you have?
So shelter care hearing within... within 72 hours. We will have our dependency fact-finding within 75 days. I do want to make sure, I mean, it's not that we don't have any pretrial procedures. I mean, there is a pretrial conference, but it's really to determine whether we need to have a fact-finding or not.
It's not a judicial settlement conference.
Correct.
We don't have judicial ones in my district, but we have a mandated, we call it pretrial conference. It's where they're all supposed to get together before the, we call it the admit and deny, but that would be your fact-finding.
Yeah.
And work it out. The judge isn't involved. And I really think it is, in a lot of places you could never do it. You couldn't do it in ours because we've only got two judges. And so if we have a judge involved, they can't hear the, takes a judge out. And so we just can't do it.
Exactly, yeah. I jumped over a step. So 72 hours shelter care hearing, shelter care review within 30 days, case conference within 30 days. Case conference is where it's legislatively mandated that everybody get together and work on the service plan. Agree. I wouldn't call it a settlement conference because there isn't anybody there that can help the parties settle. It's just the parties getting together. Fact finding within 75 days. We're going to have a permanency planning hearing at 12 months from placement, and then every 12 months after that. Dependency review hearings are 6 months following placement, and then 6 months thereafter. Termination petition has to be filed within 15, if the child's been out of the home for 15 of the last 22 months, unless there's a good cause exception. That's federal law. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's codified for us as well. And that's it. Okay. I don't think I missed one.
On the fact-finding, you say within 75 days. How many cases are truly being resolved within 75 days? Because we have a 60-day statute, and at least in Multnomah County, I can't guarantee you that we're not getting cases done in 60 days.
So our timeliness report, when I say our, I'm not meaning the Office of Public Defense, I'm meaning the Center for Court Research, has to report to the legislature each year about whether courts are meeting these benchmarks. And obviously different counties have different success rates, but some counties are like 95%, some counties are like 70%. I can't remember exactly what the statewide average is, but for the most part, cases are being resolved within 75 days.
Is King County in your...
Will be July 1st.
Okay, so all of this success and speed excludes your largest urban county.
Correct.
Okay. So we don't need to pay
attention. We don't need to worry about it anymore.
Well, we do, but yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah. But we do have three other, right? So we have Pierce County, which and Spokane, which are number two and number three.
And a question about the you said that there was a review, like a peer review, of attorneys on contracts that you kind of engage in. Is there any review with other practitioners or courts or judges? Is it just strictly one-on-one with attorneys?
Not formally. But we take those phone calls and hear from judicial officers. And
so that complaint process is open to anybody, not just the parents?
Yes.
And then are there representation standards that were revised as part of this, or did you already have representation standards in Washington for parents' attorneys? In juvenile cases.
I'm trying to remember the exact date of this of the standards. There were guidelines during the pilot, mm-hmm. and I think they became standards in 2007. And they were the ABA standards were a big contributor to that. And then the Washington Defenders Association had some standards. And I think that was a part of our calculation as well.
Do you have, when you, if there's a new practitioner on board that gets the training, is there a requirement to observe a certain number of hearings or co-try a termination case, for example, before taking one on?
So, the standard, it's now in court rule.
Okay.
They have to have done dependencies for 6 months before they can ever try a termination case or have experience in complex litigation.
I want to talk about ASFA, and I want to talk about reasonable efforts. I raise this just in terms of your program, not the rest of the world or how other people see it. In what has been an extended period of low finances for anything, even the private sector to a great degree, but certainly devastatingly big fiscal problems, to what extent do you count or acknowledge the need for attorneys for parents to raise questions about the adequacy of the services that have been provided to their clients? Not that you asked me to do drug treatment and there's no basis for drug treatment, but that I want to do drug treatment and there isn't any available to me. I mean, I'm overstating it to
me,
so I don't have to make a speech. Is this something that you look at, you count? Motions practice, what was it before and what is it now, you know, that kind of stuff.
So we have our remedial services statute that says what the department's required to pay for, and it follows the federal. It's the remedial services are the same that are the timeline and reunification services in ASPA, and we hold the department accountable for that. Well, obviously, by having to make motions and that sort of thing. I'm not saying we're successful at it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying there's a definite recognition of some budgetary issues. We've done lots of trainings with our attorneys on trying to actually figure that out. If there's something that I wish there was a little more transparency around, is what exactly is the budget of the local office. And we know how much money the department has statewide, but we don't know how much they may have in a particular office. So when they say they actually don't have money for a service, it's a struggle for the attorneys to get them to prove it. But in part because people take their word for it. We know budget times are tough. So if someone comes in and says we don't have the money for it, okay, you don't have the money for it. Does that make sense?
Well, except that there's another step, and that is if my client is going to lose their children because they need drug treatment or mental health treatment and the state is unable to provide it, how can the court then terminate their rights?
I agree with you.
Now, I mean, are these, is this being raised? Are these arguments being raised?
Yeah.
And do you track them? Do you get a star in your crown for trying?
We don't. You know, in part because one thing we have to be really careful of is these are independent contractors. So we can talk about standards of representation, but we have to make sure that we're not directing them on how they represent their clients. We don't want to make them employees by saying you need to do X, Y, and Z, and we need to have access to all of your files, and we're going to check, we're going to look at every single one of your cases and check what motions you filed and that sort of thing. It's a delicate line for us to. I'd love to be able to do that, but they're not employees.
I actually do have a question. So you mentioned that children were not any less safe with this new model.
Yeah.
And I actually read the discussion paper, and it was really interesting. So I'm wondering if the rate of return to care. So we know that some kids are returned home, the case is closed, and then they come back, and. So has there been any change with that? Are you seeing more or less, or was that statistic actually trash?
So that's not a data that we have access to. We have access to the court data, but we don't have access to the department's data. So we can tell if a case has been refiled. And most of the time, or almost all the time, if a parent is coming back, a repeat customer, that child's going back into care. So we feel pretty confident in that number. But obviously, if the department has a different number, we'd be interested to hear that.
I wondered if it was declining, if parents were receiving more services up front or better defined services, if that was less likely to occur.
We're engaging on a new day with family assessment response, which is it's a differential response model, and it's starting as a pilot. It's been in three counties. It's been in effect for 2 weeks now, and there was some testimony about it just earlier this week about 58% of the kids that would have come into, it would have been a filing, have been diverted into this family assessment response. So, we're hoping that it's going to mean a reduction in number of filings, but we don't know yet. And it's just what you're talking about, the providing services up front in a less confrontational way.
Your client, your service providers, though, are not paid by the case. They're paid a monthly flat fee, right?
Correct.
And so they don't have any incentive to try to keep cases going or anything like that.
No.
One more question. Mm-hmm. With the social workers who are essentially agents of the attorney, how do you avoid conflict of interest problems?
They are only allowed to represent one parent in the case.
Okay.
And if there's a need for another social worker, we'll find one. I think we have a couple counties that have multiple social workers. Most counties only have one, so we might go and pay someone an hourly rate, have a separate contract to. In a practical manner, that doesn't happen. If one social worker is working for one member of the family, they're they're around the other member of the family too, and when the interests are similar, right? So in some respects, they end up helping both, but technically
not directly.
It's one. Yeah.
And in the rural areas, you have how many? You have how many social workers?
We have 25 throughout the state.
Okay. And so are there travel expenses for those social workers to reach the various corners
yes.
of your state?
Yeah. And they if memory serves correctly, they actually get a travel stipend as a part of their as a part of their contract. I can't remember precisely how that works or what that is, but I know that we do cover that.
Has this resulted in a network being kind of... It sounds like it has.
Absolutely. And one of the benefits that I don't think we anticipated was, let's say you have the dependency in one county, but the parent lives in another county. We're able to use that county, the social worker in that county, to help them out. And that's really beneficial because the department social worker is really a courtesy supervision worker in that county who has less of an interest in that case. So it's been really helpful for her.
So if you have to move, say, your residential treatment programs in another county, you can hook them up with your social worker there.
Sure.
Have you done salary and benefit comparison between your attorneys who, if they are grossing $102,000 and have all their overhead taxes, their own benefits, their own retirement, et cetera, and their opponents in the Attorney General's office in terms of what their salary and benefits are, what's the disparity?
We haven't done one recently. I know that when the dollar amounts were figured out originally, it was to reduce the amount of parity. My understanding is it still isn't in 100% equal, but we're a lot closer. I think we're close. And it needs to be done again because enough time has gone by. So I wish I could answer that better.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if your definition of close and my definition of close are the same. That's just not very much money, regardless of how much it sounds, to run a business, pay yourself a living wage when you're going into court. As much as I love Lori,
yep.
We're in the same courtroom. The disparity between what we make is substantial.
Yep.
Same with Joanne.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're doing better than we are, though. I mean, ours is terrible.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, he's suggesting it is, but I just don't know if that's the case.
I can tell you, it's a drastic improvement from what was there before.
I don't doubt that.
And then that isn't necessarily true in every single county, though. There are a few counties, particularly some of the more rural counties, that were paying people $90 an hour. So, and I think if you work ours out, it's more along the lines of $75 an hour if you were figuring out an hourly rate. Depends on how much time the attorney puts into the cases, but yeah.
It's a lot better than 40.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Well, we grilled you. Your legal training. Thank you very much. You've given us a lot to think about, and we've got, I think, a lot of really good information here that's going to be really helpful with us in our task. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Madam Chair, I just thought of one last
thing, okay.
And it's not grilling. You have an opportunity, and I would like you to take advantage of it. If you were starting this over again, do you have any advice for us? And maybe leave this as an open question so you can think about it. In other words, we're at the beginning of this process that started more than 10 years ago in Washington. And what would you do differently? What would you recommend we do differently if you can think of anything? Thank you.
I'll have to think a little bit about the do differently part. Because I came in as an excited contractor, as someone who this program benefited greatly. So I'm pretty invested in how it worked out for me. In terms of words of advice, I can remember the very first day in court. Wow, I was raring to go. I had so many different things that I was gonna, so many motions I was gonna make, and so many ways that I was going to change the system overnight. And fortunately, we had a very wise judge. Judge Godfrey came out, and he knew, and he could see it in our faces. He knew what was going on, and he came in and said, look, this is all going to take time. Everybody just relax. And it turned out to be true. I think what you see is that there's a little bit of a culture shift in courts when the attorneys have time. And it does upset the apple cart a little bit. And everyone comes in with some preconceived notions that they can see the excitement on the attorneys' faces. They now know more. They're better trained. And they now feel empowered. So everyone's got to adjust a little bit. But it takes about 6 months, and then everybody kind of finds their equilibrium, and the system runs much better. But it's not without some hiccups and consternation.
Thanks.
Yeah. Sorry, that led to one more question. Do you have a sort of intensive upfront training now for your lawyers who are entering this program for the first time?
Yeah, we try to do an orientation training for them.
Thank you.
Do you know whether the program has resulted in the need for more judicial hours, in that you're doing just what you talked about, or does it balance out because there are more cases settled earlier because of the contact with the clients?
I don't think that's been studied. Our belief is that because the system runs more efficiently, that there's less judicial hours, but I can't swear to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other business for the committee? Are we ready to adjourn?
Abernathy shows up and we just finish. All right, we're adjourned and we've got our marching orders. Thank you.